Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us here in New York City in the studio, I'm pleased to say, Chris Grisanti, Grisanti Capital Management CEO, our value man, who says, don't worry about Democrats taking the House, don't worry about higher rates, and don't worry about inflation. Can we start with politics, Chris?
Sure,
why shouldn't we worry about the politics at the moment?
I think almost the consensus view is that the Democrats will take the House. It's very difficult to see them taking the Senate. So I think the market has priced in divided government. It's not like a whole lot has gotten done before this. So I don't think if come the day after Election Day, we see a divided Congress that it's going to upset the market, maybe a little volatility, maybe some opportunity.
But it has been so market positive with Republicans in the House and Republicans running the Senate as well. Right. Why does the opposite not apply?
Well, we've gotten the tax break. We will continue to get lower regulation because that's an executive function. So I think that the trends that have propelled the market can continue. Of course, the big wild card is if the House is goes Democratic, whether we'll see lots of investigations. But I think the final release of the Mueller report will set that to rest one way or another.
In terms of the trade policy, the president kind of ramping things up again, threatening to tax all imports coming from China. And the data over the weekend from the Chinese, the trade data, surplus might be narrowing, but with the United States, it is a record.
Right.
Doesn't look good for the Chinese if they're trying to argue with the president they're doing something.
It's hard to have sympathy for the Chinese in some ways, but here you kind of do because the trade deficit typically widens, and Tom will be able to tell this better than I, because we're having strong economic times and we just buy more stuff because people have jobs. So the deficit would widen. The problem is that's Trump's major litmus test for whether things are fair or not.
I don't care about the politics. Here's the reality. We're 10 years on from Lehman.
Right.
We're only talking to optimists this week that had the courage to stay in the market. How did you stay in the market in April of 2009?
Well, we ran to quality, Tom. So you buy J.P. Morgan, you buy Goldman Sachs. It was the first time really in a generation where they were trading significantly below.
What did he buy
below
Bear Stearns for, like a dollar? It was like $24. Like
he bought it for $2, and then he had to up the price to $10 because he got so many complaints about.
And you loaded the boat on J.P. Morgan.
We did because, you know, if J.P. Morgan went under, we had a lot
worse.
Okay,
but John Farrell, what was the sweat like in London with Northern Rock? Nobody was loading the boat on Northern Rock,
and
were they?
Good job they didn't.
Right.
I mean, that was the story. Exactly. And if you loaded the boat on RBS, I mean, you are still struggling right now. That's the difference, I think, between the United Kingdom and, say, the United States. The U.S. did such a much better job of recapitalizing the banks than the rest of Europe
did. And they
did.
Took their medicine early. I think that's right, because I think Europe is still doing that.
But we talk and sit here with the benefit of hindsight.
Right.
When you talk about loading the boat of J.P. Morgan 10 years ago, it didn't seem that obvious, did it?
No. I mean, that's why you could do it. Although there is some, as the boat goes underwater, you head to the highest point. You head to the quality. You could have done J.P. Morgan. You could have done Wells Fargo. And by the way, in retrospect, neither Wells Fargo nor J.P. Morgan had a single quarter of reported losses during that period.
Yeah, but did you sell them now? Or do you only own junk now? Do you only own things with five symbols?
No, we've sold J.P. Morgan simply because it's quadrupled since then. But we own and would buy today the Wells Fargo because of company-specific problems, which I think they will grow out of.
What's the differential in value between J.P. Morgan? What ratio do you use to compare and contrast JPM with WFC?
We use both price-to-book and price-to-earnings. In both cases, Wells, because of their mix of
business—
How much
of a discount?
Right now, they're trading almost at parity, but the proviso is, Tom, Wells usually trades at almost a 50% premium because it has a more stable book of businesses, mortgages, it's kind of bread and butter lending, where J.P. Morgan is more trading. So you can buy Wells. If they get the same historic premium, you'll make 50% on your money.
Chris, can we get a quick word from you on Apple?
Sure.
Big launch later this week. I know you hold the stock.
We do.
What are you looking for?
You know, it's funny. We're contrarians, so it's hard to sit here and defend Apple. But it's just done everything right. It's not terribly expensive. And what we love are two things that people don't usually talk about, which is all the cash that's coming back. And second, the services business, which has gone, it's almost like Amazon Web Services, the hidden gem of Amazon. Here you have the Apple services business where they're selling apps and everything else. And that's gone from zero to almost 10% of the revenue. And we think it's heading to 20 to 25% of the revenue.
The company revealing late last last week that some of the tariffs coming through will hit some of their products. The president's saying there's an easy solution to that. Onshore, some of your production. I'm sure it's not that obvious for Apple and not that simplistic either, but does it mean anything to you?
Because the problem with all this trade stuff is you have to make multi-year capital spending decisions based on stuff that can change. So no company is going to do that until we get some certainty there. And so that, Jonathan, coming full circle, that's the big wild card in this market.
Do share buybacks and dividend growth support the market into 2019? Or, like, you know, it has.
Right.
Or will there be a change behavior?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I think it continues to be a tailwind, Tom, but I don't think we need it. I think for the first time since the crisis, we have increasing employment, increasing wages for the first time. So you've got a bunch of tailwinds, of which share buybacks are simply one of them.
Chris Cusanti.
Thank you.
Great to catch up with you.
Why don't you bring in James?
He is one of the
O'Sullivan.
Most accurate payrolls forecasters on the planet.
Yeah.
Jim O'Sullivan joining us from High Frequency Economics, the chief U.S. economist. Jim, what did you look for Friday and did you get it?
Hi, John. Morning, Tom. Well, it was actually a bit stronger on the payroll side than expected, plus on the wage side, obviously, as well. So, they were pretty strong numbers. I mean, obviously, monthly numbers jump around a lot, but I mean, it's pretty unambiguous that we keep getting something in the range of 200,000 a month on jobs, which, even though unemployment held in Friday's number, is more than enough over time to keep unemployment coming down. Meanwhile, wages are accelerating.
Yeah, but Jim, there is this feeling, and I've called you one of the most accurate forecasters because you are, but there are many people out there that say this has got a whole lot more predictable over the last couple of years, and wage growth has been pretty stable. Payrolls growth has been stable around 200,000 every single month. Can we break out to a higher trend on wage growth, Jim?
Well, I think the trend, has been moving up and will continue to move up. I mean, the 2.9% year-over-year we saw on Friday is a new high, and that's going to keep on going up. And I think we've seen the same already, in fact, in the employment cost index, which, if anything, is more comprehensive. And the private wage number in that report was already up to 2.9%.
So what's the sweat at the Fed? I mean, coming off for Friday, which I thought made a nice splash, and, you know, into the weekend, make America great again and all that, what's the level of sweat or the change in the level of sweat at the Fed?
Well, I mean, like everyone else, I'm sure they're watching the trade war threats and trade tensions as something to monitor. In terms of the labor market itself, the numbers on Friday, what they're worrying about is ultimately unemployment keeps on falling and the economy overheats. The unemployment rate at 3.9 is already below the median Fed official estimate of what's sustainable over the long run, 4.5%. And while the inflation numbers right now, and I would say even the wage numbers right now, are pretty much where they want to see them, I mean, the question is, do they stop at these readings, or do they keep on accelerating because unemployment's too low? So I think ultimately, they're, in terms of the labor market, they're worrying about ultimately this is unsustainably strong.
Jim, that Fed staff paper that came out over the weekend at Jackson Hole several weekends back, do you think that is the guide? Just follow the unemployment rate. And does that make sense to you?
Well, historically, I mean, they've always put a lot of emphasis on the unemployment rate as a key slack indicator. And of course, I mean, broadly, I mean, what are the Fed goals? Fed's goals, I mean, they're full employment and price stability. And I mean, they're defining full employment right now, at least, as 4.5% unemployment rate over the long haul. So, yeah, I mean, it's never been so simple that the only thing that matters for inflation is the unemployment rate, but, I mean, it's clearly an important indicator from their perspective.
Jim, review for us the quality of the jobs being created. I mean, if we make the assumption everybody got 200,000 a month wrong because proper job growth was 150, 160, 130, whatever, that marginal job growth that surprised even the optimists, are they good jobs?
I think they're probably pretty average jobs on average, in the sense that, you know, some of them are above average and some of them are below average. And I think that's inevitable when you've got 150 million jobs in terms of the level. I mean, half of them are above average and half of them are below average. I'm not just trying to be facetious here, but the my point is that when you look at average hourly earnings going up 2.9%, and that's a pure average. So, I mean, that's similar to what we're seeing, for instance, in the employment cost index, which is a, a weighted index. I mean, this is a little technical, but if you were consistently mm-hmm. seeing below average wage jobs created, you'd see the average hourly earnings number, which is a pure average, go up much, much less than the employment cost index, which is a fixed weighted index. But they're pretty much consistent right now. So the implication is, yeah, they're above average jobs and there are below average jobs. But
yeah.
on average, I mean, the new jobs being created are probably not all that different from the stock of jobs that's already out there, the 150 million jobs that are already out there.
Jim, at this stage of the cycle, given where unemployment is, where is this payrolls growth coming from?
Well, I mean, it's across the board in terms of sectors for sure. And it's not as if when you hit the roughly what full employment is, and of course there's no clear right answer on what full employment is. I mean, 4.5% is in the Fed's estimate for what's sustainable over the long haul. I mean, 3.9 is obviously a bit below that. But it's not as if you suddenly hit a wall where you run out of workers. I mean, at this point of the cycle, then certainly workers are harder to find, and gradually we start seeing the wage numbers drift up. So I think that's the point we're at. And I mean, certainly over time, you would expect, I mean, the payroll numbers to slow a bit just because companies can't find workers.
Yeah, but I guess the reason I asked this question, Jim, is because I was told this 2 years ago.
Yeah, although I don't think anyone would have really said you suddenly hit a wall, that you suddenly can't, employment growth goes from 200,000 to
No, but they said expected to slow, expected to go down towards 100,000, yeah. expected to go to maintenance rates. It didn't.
I don't know. I would have questioned that. I mean, just because you've hit more or less full employment. And again, it's also plausible that maybe instead of 200,000 a month, we'd be getting 250 a month right now. I mean, if the unemployment rate were higher. There's been a lot of stimulus in the economy recently. Growth has actually accelerated. And meanwhile, I mean, you are seeing the wage numbers starting to pick up. So that's where the pressure is coming through.
15 weeks ago, it was like, okay, this is as good as it gets. It'll taper off. Where have you adjusted your taper now? Have you extended this good growth into Q4 and even into 2019?
I haven't changed any numbers recently. I mean, I've got 3% for the second half of this year, so still pretty good. I mean, I don't think the trend is over 4%, which is what the Q2 number was. I mean, 4.2% for the second quarter. But, I mean, I've got 3% for the second half. I mean, that said, I think the temptation would be to, if anything, go up a bit from 3% in the second half. That momentum looks so good. I mean, last week, obviously, the ISM numbers that came out, I mean, the jobless claims numbers are at their lowest since 1969.
Yeah.
But I do think ultimately, I mean, taper, of course, is the sort of a monetary policy word these days. But in terms of growth, I mean, I think the fiscal stimulus will start fading as we get into 2019. And I think as the Fed keeps tightening every quarter, that gradually monetary policy becomes less accommodative as well. So I think it's pretty plausible that growth does start to slow by 2019.
Jim O'Sullivan, thank you so much with High Frequency Economics this morning. And now, folks, our definitive discussion today on trade and the ramifications for you. Mary Lovely is always powerful in intellect with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. But the real joy is Mary Lovely combined with her colleague, Chad Bone. And the two of them, almost, it seems, writing every other day, maybe every 3 days, have put out a body of work that I know has made me smarter about the trade debate. Mary, what's the next thing you write for Peterson?
Oh, thanks so much for that. Well, we're particularly looking at just the sum total of what's going on and how it will make American businesses either less competitive in international marketplaces or force companies to move some of their operations offshore. I think that's the real challenge that we're seeing right now. We're looking a little longer term, beyond sort of day-to-day movements in the market and thinking longer term about competitiveness.
If it's make America great again, in a mercantile thinking of the president, or neo-mercantilist, I guess I should say, is it make China weak again? Can the president, with these actions, diminish China GDP or throw them into some form of recession?
Well, it definitely can have an effect on China. I think that the view that the U.S. is powerful enough to get them to their knees where they will just wholeheartedly accept Trump's demands is wrong, however. Our purchases of their manufactured goods are only about 3% of their total revenue. It's important in other ways, however, to them, and they're always have their own internal struggles that this can make worse. I think it is an attempt to hurt them to get what we want. Unfortunately, even if we do hurt them, we won't get what we want, which is some sanity in terms of intellectual property regimes and treatment of our intellectual property and technology. This is something that, of course, we share with other countries such as Japan and the European Union.
With the distraction of trade, as you and the Combine, I think of Nick Lardy and the rest at Peterson, does the distraction of trade dramatically damage investment by U.S. companies and particularly U.S. multinationals? I'd give a U.S. multinational now, their heads must be spinning over where the next marginal investment dollar goes.
Yes, and there's certainly an attempt by the administration to not have U.S. companies invest in China and, quote, to bring the jobs home. That is a powerful, I think, rhetorical tool.
Okay, but Mary, I just set up a new router at my home. Thank you, Netgear. And it was made in Vietnam. I mean, the debate, and this is no fault of Mary Lovely, folks, who teaches at Syracuse. It's not China, China, China. But the debate in the media is always U.S.-China, Mary, and you know it's a much richer set of adjacencies.
It is, and that's why we're worried about U.S. competitiveness, because it's a big world. There's lots of other countries out there. If we look at even U.S. operations in China, about 70% of the goods that they're selling are being sold into Asia. So how would tariffs on imports back to the United States stop those companies from moving to Asia? It won't. Asia is where the market growth is. It's where these companies need to be to make sure that they're profitable and return value for investors. So this bilateral focus of the president keeps him from seeing the bigger game. Part of that is seeing what our multinationals are doing abroad. The other, of course, is, as you point out, that there's a lot of other low-income countries who are ready to either take more investment or finish off the goods so that they come from, say, Vietnam, even with Chinese components.
I mean, within the microeconomics are wedges and incentives. What are the incentives now that the president's creating with tranche one of taxes and now tranche two of trade taxes? What is the key incentive there that people have to adapt and adjust to?
Well, it's going to raise the price of bringing in intermediate goods to the United States. And so we'll reorient some, certainly supply chains. As you know, it's possible for them to simply import goods from other countries, other low-wage countries, or we can produce it here at a higher cost. It's essentially producing a production island for the United States, and that will force companies to move production for export outside the United States. That's the dynamic that it's setting up, and that's really not good for workers or for investors.
I'm not going to put out this chart because it's Monday and my brain's fried. I'll put out the link to it. And Mary, this is Paul Krugman, who, you know, people go mental because Professor Krugman's talking about this, this, or this. This is the Krugman wheelhouse. This is the Lovely wheelhouse as well. If you've got a dynamic on the y-axis, Mary, of the price of imports coming in, and on the other side, you've got the units, the volume of imports coming in. You have a demand for imports based on the price of them and the units of them. And you end up in a trade war with what Professor Krugman and you would call a welfare loss. What's the welfare loss to our listeners?
Well, it's basically that we're going to be forced to pay more for inputs and will drive up the cost of our goods. And people will say, well, that will create jobs. Yes, it will create jobs in the protected industry, but it has to take jobs from someplace else. When I have to pay more for my children's clothing or for toys or for mobile phones, all of which are threatened with the last tranche of Chinese tariffs, that means that I can't buy myself a nice dress at the store, or upgrade my router, or buy a new car. That means jobs are not created in those other industries. So basically, you see the first thing, oh, well, there's a job created in protected industry X. Well, you fail to see is the job that wasn't created in another industry. And those other industries tend to be the export industries that pay more. They're firms that do more R&D. And frankly, they're firms that are going to drive innovation in the future. So we're really just hampering ourselves and the future generation.
Beautifully explained. I feel like this is not like Econ 101. It's like Econ 2 or 3 or 204. But within it, Mary, is the idea of the marginal or the next dollar I spend or the next tradable item. When the president looks at the blunt instrument of car sales, Germany bad, we're good. I mean, the simplistic tone, and that's not a criticism of President Trump, folks. It's just a fact. It's a simplistic analysis. Drag President Trump over to the dynamic space that Mary Lovely's in. Where's the complexity of that simplistic debate?
Well, where is the complexity? I think there are a lot of people who are trying to explain this to the president or to make their views heard. We saw many, many companies testifying in the hearings that were held for this latest tranche of taxes against Chinese imports. We saw tens of thousands of companies ask for exemptions from the steel and aluminum tariffs. So the business world is trying to get the message out. This is not good for us. You're hurting us in terms of the price of the goods that we need to produce in the U.S.
Yeah.
And eventually it will show up in jobs.
This has been wonderful, Mary Lovely. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate your attendance on Bloomberg Surveillance over the last number of weeks. Can't say enough about what they're doing at Peterson. The book is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Nomi Prinz with us. We've been talking about an international focus there. Nomi, James Dimon wanders in on page 18 in a compare and contrast of the J.P. Morgan Bear Stearns effort with the United States of America government versus stimulus effects and bailout effects of the international economy. From where you sit, what is the state of America banking? Are they truly too big to fail?
They remain too big to fail. It's ironic. I actually worked for both of those firms. They're too big to fail because they actually existed on the subsidy. I mean, the $4.5 trillion at the height, now $4.2 trillion of the Fed, that's the cheap money and so forth. They're able to sort of like bring themselves back from the brink. But in the process, the larger banks have collectively become larger. There was an act that Frank passed in 2010 that was supposed to ostensibly reduce some of their risk. And as Lisa mentioned before, there has been some deleveraging throughout. However, they still remain reliant on that supply of money, on the quantitative easing that has propped up some of the treasury assets that have gone through them, the mortgage assets that have gone through them, how they're reevaluating and have over the years those assets up. So they're not as healthy as they look. They've just had more money.
But within your book, Collusion, there's no chapter on Canada. What's wrong with the Canadian system of like 5 or 6 or 7 banks?
The reason I don't have a chapter on Canada is because they didn't really rate in the whole sort of quantitative easing of the rest of the major G7 countries and plus China that I do look at as the major central banks in terms of creating electronic money through this process. They've had a more stable and less leveraged banking system to begin with. They weren't actually at the sort of crux of the crisis when it happened. Emerging markets were much in pain. Canada was to an extent in pain. Europe was in major pain and became so because of Greece, because of other debt problems, because of major bank problems and things like Deutsche, which continue and so forth. So there were just more problems throughout some of the other banking systems, and Canadian banks have been just relatively less helped and more stable going into this period.
As we reflect on what happened 10 years ago, I have to wonder about the risk that has moved out of the banking system and into the asset management world. And there's been a lot of discussion about this, whether it's private equity firms taking a lot of the direct lending to smaller and mid-sized businesses that big banks once did. How concerned are you that that is the next front lines of whatever crisis emerges?
That is such an excellent question. It's at the front lines because if we have any kind of unraveling through different points of possibility, whether that's geopolitics, whether that's you know, emerging market debt defaults, corporate debt defaults. We've seen it in the U.S. Non-financial corporates have almost doubled from $3.2 trillion debt to $6.21 trillion debt over this period and so forth. And these asset management companies have grown on the back of what has been a bull market that has been largely artificially injected by quantitative easing and the results of that money coming in and investors and speculators in these funds looking for returns on the back of that money. So if that unravels, then the returns that these growing asset management companies have been producing will start to unravel as well. When debt starts to, if it starts to default, it takes money, therefore, out of the stock market to pay for the liabilities of that debt and so forth. And it becomes this sort of circular cascade. And that ultimately means that all of these purchasers, these asset management companies and the larger ones that have grown, that have purchased these assets over the years, have to start seeing losses and have to start taking money out for redemptions from some of their customers as well.
Right. Well, I guess that then the follow-up question is, are any of these asset managers systemically important, or is this just sort of this sort of cycle of liquidity withdrawal that happens anytime there's a market sell-off?
The reason they're more systemically important than they were, and of course they're not insured, so these assets are not FDIC insured, and there's no sort of government tie to them. So as a result, that's why they're a bit more dangerous. They're systemically important because they have bought a lot of the assets. They've been part of sort of the party of inflating on the back of the cheap money that has been created. But we don't necessarily don't have to bail them out.
Okay, but Nomi, can't there be a good outcome? I mean, you've been the great critic of the process, the methodology of developed countries solving the problem, whatever the price is down the road and wherever that price travels. But can't there be a, if you and Chairman Bernanke were to sit down together, can't there be a constructive outcome to the financial system, or do you just throw in the towel?
Well, I have to look at the financial system and the general economies in combination, and I think there can be solutions and even unwind possibilities to what we have.
What are those unwind possibilities right now?
Well, unwind possibilities right now are sort of rates go too high, or there's currency protections throughout the world, and that basically instills just a sort of freeze. That's a far case scenario because of other factors. But I think you can solve some of that by going back to the core of why supposedly this money was created to begin with. It was created to basically inflate the economy, even
agreed,
though what it did
agree, 100%
agree. If we do that, we can defer it to that. We can basically say, look, there's all these debt in different countries, whether it's the ECB creating it, the Bank of Japan,
right,
the Fed. And deflect it, move it to more infrastructure, more long-term, more sort of sustainable, and actually follow that money. Right now, if you follow the money, the lines are all the correlation and causation as to the markets. But if you follow it into sort of real long-term sustainable projects,
okay,
investment, development, so forth, you get a more structured future.
Do you just assume,
right,
Nomi, do you just assume stronger dollar in this great unwind?
The dollar tends to be the recipient in the great unwind just because of the flight to quality, the flight to safety that's perceived in the fact that it remains the reserve currency. Throughout this decade, there has been more movement to other currencies, other trade alliances, and so forth, and some of the trade wars will continue to make that happen. However, the dollar still remains at the top of that pile. So if there's an acute problem, the dollar does go up. That said, in the wake of the 2008 crisis, the dollar got basically creamed right away because of the fact that it started in the financial system of the U.S. So it really depends on how it also plays out.
Nomi, thank you so much. Nomi Prinz, all the president's bankers, and she follows with a really terse 256 pages, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Very controversial. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.